The next case on our calendar today is State of Minnesota versus Tyree Earl Chapman. Good morning. Council will each have 15 minutes for, or each party will have 15 minutes for oral argument, and council for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Take the time you need to get settled, and then when you're ready, council for appellant can proceed. If you can please identify yourself and the party you represent when you proceed, that would be helpful. And you can adjust the podium if need be. Also, there's a clock with the time on the podium.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant Tyree Chapman. Mr. Chapman's conviction must be overturned because the statements he made on the way to the jail were a product of interrogation by Sergeant Parmarenke after Mr. Chapman made multiple requests for counsel in violation of his Miranda rights and his rights under Edwards. Well, secondly,
just to be clear, you describe in your brief the continuing of a conversation.
Correct.
And you've just described that continuing of a conversation as interrogation. Are you suggesting those two terms are synonymous?
Well, I'm suggesting that the comments made by Sergeant Parmarenke towards the end of the recorded conversation was interrogation and were statements made with the intent to elicit an incriminating response, which shortly thereafter elicited an incriminating response. Secondly, Mr. Chapman's conviction should be overturned because Sergeant Parmarenke twice referenced the suppressed statement and admitted to and told the jury that Mr. Chapman had admitted that he had woken up in while his daughter was performing fellatio on him. I don't plan on addressing the third issue, and I'll rely on my brief for that point. This court has a de novo review over the totality of the circumstances to determine whether or not Mr. Chapman reinitiated the conversation that was ongoing with Parmarenke. And the burden is on the state to establish that a reinitiation took place. And here the state failed to do so. Yes?
For that finding of fact of whether it was one continuous interrogation or the interrogation stopped and it was a voluntary reinitiation, that's a finding of fact, though, correct? I know it's mixed law and fact.
Well, I
but
don't.
But there are factual findings in there, and then where we are left with a clear error standard.
Well, I don't agree with that. I would say that I'm not contesting any of the judge's findings whatsoever. There was only one witness who testified, and we're not contesting any of his testimony. The only thing we're contesting is the judge's determination, a legal determination of whether or not the comments made very shortly after interrogation had been going on with Sergeant Parmarenke, whether that reinitiated the conversation or whether the conversation was ongoing. I don't think the judge actually made a finding of fact that the conversation was ongoing. I think her ruling, I believe it was a her ruling in this case, was essentially that it was reinitiated, and that is a determination that this court gets to review de novo based on Munson. And this case has a lot of similarities to Munson, and particularly I would have this court look at the end of the recorded conversation, where at that point Mr. Chapman has on multiple occasions requested counsel, yet the Sergeant Parmarenke says to the interpreter, tell Chapman, and he says him, that if he wants to talk to me at a later time, he knows where I'm at. I will give him my card. And he also mentions that the attorneys are going to charge him, and the comments that Mr. Chapman makes shortly thereafter, which aren't recorded, but comments that he makes shortly thereafter are in direct response to these things that Parmarenke has just said to him. He makes a comment about, if I'm going to be charged with something, I should be charged with marijuana sales and not rape. So that's
a
direct...
At that point, the interpreters had left, correct?
That's correct.
And the officer and the appellant were in the holding cell to go back to the, were in the holding cell, right?
Well, they're no longer in the interview room. I don't know that it's exactly clear of how far out of the interview room they are. And again, the burden is on the state to establish those facts, and I don't think the state did an adequate job of establishing the time frame between these last comments by Pomeranke to Mr. Chapman and when Mr. Chapman actually made those statements. So because the state doesn't meet that burden, the assumption is that those statements happened very quickly after the conversation in the recorded conversation has ended.
So,
but given that the, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Given that the interpreters had left and the formal interrogation had ceased, what evidence is there to support your view that that the interview was ongoing or that the interrogation was ongoing?
Well, it's based on the comments that Sergeant Pomeranke makes at the end of the formal interview. And NS talks about statements that are made with the intent to elicit an incriminating response. And that's what we have here. When Pomeranke says, if he wants to talk to me at a later time, he knows where I'm at, I will give him my card. I mean, that's a statement to induce him to say something. When he's talking about what you're potentially going to be charged with, that induces him to ask a question while they're walking to the jail about what he potentially could be charged with, or makes a comment about what he should potentially be charged with. He also, this is probably not as clear, but saying you're going back down to that stuffy hole is essentially, hey, you're going back to jail. Cops say things like that to people because then they hope that they try to talk themselves out of what's about to happen, that the fact that they're going to be charged.
Going back to this about the sergeant making statements about what's going to happen next, I mean, from the transcript, it looks like he's saying it's not to me to decide, whether this ruins his life. It's up to the attorney to decide that if he talks to me. And then he says if he is charged, the only other thing, if he is charged, he will have his first court appearance tomorrow around 9 o'clock or so. At that time, there will be an attorney appointed to him. So you're not saying that statement. Is there anything problematic with that statement? Is that part of your basis for challenging this? I just want to understand.
Well, the other statements clearly are more intentional to elicit a incriminating response. I would say that that statement, like once you've requested an attorney, that's the end of the conversation. So he shouldn't be saying anything to him. Mr. Chapman was not asking, hey, what's going to happen next? He's not asking Pomeranke, what am I going to be charged with, until Pomeranke puts those thoughts into his head. Pomeranke is continuing the conversation after he's supposed to stop it. So all those additional things all go to the totality of the circumstances, but clearly those statements are not as intentional to elicit an incriminating response as the other statements.
Sergeant Pomeranke says that I usually ask these biographical questions before giving Miranda. In this case, didn't happen, and so he waits until after your client invokes his right to counsel and then asks the biographical questions. How does that factor into our analysis and into your argument?
Well, that's helpful here because one of the factual findings that the judge made is that those biographical questions were interrogation. Those qualified as interrogation. Those were intended to elicit an incriminating response, and they did. So I think that's something that, again, and part of the totality of the circumstances, is we know that this officer or the sergeant was not taking no for an answer. He was not following Miranda and Edwards and all these other rules that have been in place for years. He just kept badgering this guy and got what he wanted by getting this statement moments after the formal interview had finished.
So can you distinguish this case from the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State v. Paul? That's the, and you can do that later too if you want to review that.
Well, the part that stood out for me in Paul is actually the, and kind of goes to the second prong here of the test that's announced in Munson, mm-hmm. is that, first you have to show that there's been a reinitiation, and then second, there has to be a waiver, you know, of that right to counsel. And Paul, after the Supreme Court ruled that there wasn't a reinitiation, as they did find in Munson, they ruled the other way. I would say this case is closer to Munson. But in Paul, there actually is a formal waiver at that point. The officers do get Paul to go back through and waive his Miranda rights. And I think that plays some role here, especially when you're talking about the Fruits analysis, is that the Fruits cases that we rely on all deal with cases where there's an improper violation of Miranda, but then the officers kind of remove that taint by there being some time delay, and then there is a formal waiver done. And I think that that happens in Elstead and maybe one of the other cases either that the state cites or I cite, and that's not done here. You know, once Mr. Chapman starts talking again, according to that second prong, there should be a, you know, the officer should stop him and say, let's go back to this room. Let's go get the, if you want to talk to me, this needs to be done right. Let's go back and potentially, I would probably still argue because it's so close after the Miranda violations that it maybe doesn't remove the taint. But we don't have that here at all because there is no additional Miranda given as there was in Paul, as there was in Elstead, and in some of these other cases. So that's why our case is different from those cases. I'd like to move on to this.
The second Miranda is required when there's additional interrogation.
Correct.
The second Miranda would not be required if there were spontaneous comments volunteered by the defendant, and even in custody.
Yes, I believe that's a state's argument. My argument, again, would be that because the interrogation was so quickly, that happened so quickly before these spontaneous, or as you refer to them as spontaneous statements, that they're too interlinked to say that, you know, a waiver wouldn't have been needed. Because it happens too closely by. We can't just purge this thing that just happened, these multiple violations that just happened, from the comments that are made so shortly after. I'd like to move on to this.
Is there any evidence in the record, and I'm mindful of, you know, the burden being on the state, about the time delay between turning off the tape recorder and the conversation in the holding area?
I don't believe there is, and if it is, it's very vague. The officer does not testify, this happened 5 minutes later, this happened 10 minutes later. We were waiting forever to get into the holding cell, and so, you know, the guy, you know, that's why he talks, or there's nothing like that in the record. And again, that's the state's burden. The state could have asked those questions of their witness to prove that part. Regarding the second point, I really want to hone in on the fact that this is Sergeant Pomeranke is testifying about the statements that are found suppressible. Now, he says it in the context of saying that my client made this incriminating response on the way to the jail holding area, but it is a reference to the earlier statement that the judge found suppressible. Now, there wasn't an objection at that time to the initial statement, but there doesn't need to be under Litzau and the criminal rule procedure that says once you've successfully argued something pretrial, you don't have to make a objection at the time of the improper statement coming in. There is, Pomeranke is stopped for the second statement, which the state seems to argue is not a reference to that suppressible statement, but I just wanted to point out that it is, because Pomeranke says, for the second statement, he says, he had, and I'm quoting, he had made a statement prior that he had woke up to his daughter suck. So woke up to his daughter is a comment. The only time that comes, or the only time we see that in that this case, is the suppressible statement. That's what Chapman says on page 10 of that statement, is that he woke up to his daughter performing fellatio on him. Right. Talia King does not say that to Officer Pomeranke. And when Pomeranke testifies that Talia King said that Chapman admitted that something similar to that happened, she doesn't say the woke up part of it. So Pomeranke, in that second statement to the jury, is referring to Chapman's suppressed statement. The third statement at that point is just damage control, because they state and whoever else realizes that Pomeranke has kind of gone rogue here and talked about things he's not supposed to talk about. But clearly the jury is going to, you know, they heard the first statement, which they weren't told to disregard. They hear the second statement, which they're told to disregard, but is consistent with the first statement. And then they hear this third statement that's totally out of left field, where the cop is guessing that Chapman means by incident what Pomeranke has heard from Talia King telling him what Chapman had said. So, you know, the jury is really left with this statement that's provided that had been suppressed by the district court judge and that should not have been referenced by Pomeranke. He was told by the prosecutor not to reference it. The judge talked for pages in the transcript about making sure Pomeranke doesn't refer to the suppressed statement. And then he refers to it at least on two separate occasions. One of the times the judge finally stops him from saying it.
Assuming we agree with you on that point, that doesn't end our inquiry, then we have to determine whether it had a significant impact on the jury's verdict. And there was a lot of significant testimony from the victim and the aunt and the and other testimony that would support the jury's verdict. So what is your argument that it had a significant impact on the jury's verdict?
I see that I'm out of time. Would you prefer I finish or answer this in rebuttal or answer no?
You can go ahead and answer it
briefly.
Briefly, okay. And yes. Then expand on it in your rebuttal if necessary.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think this is pointed out in my brief, but I'll just say it quickly here, is that the jury only believes that one act of sexual penetration happens in this case, and that's the fellatio on one occasion. The jury finds that the state didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt any additional allegations by this girl took place, and both the first statement and the second statement essentially go directly to providing corroboration by Chapman of that act of fellatio took place. That's why it's so damaging here. That's why, you know, those comments had been proved or should not have been admitted, and that's why it's so damaging here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being brief. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, John Schmidt, assistant Hennepin County attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm the conviction because the appellant's limited spontaneous statement was properly admitted, and the post-verdict recanting statement did not entitle appellant to post-conviction relief. Regarding the initial statement, the spontaneous statement that occurred at the jail, that the court's findings below are reviewed for clear error in terms of the facts that occurred and the facts that came about from the Rasmussen hearing. So within that, the only evidence that we have is the police officer's testimony. And the testimony was the interrogation had ended. They were walking back to the jail, and the defendant was making statements to the officer, the sergeant, saying, "I want to clear my conscience," and started making other statements. Within that, again, reviewed for clear error, is that the sergeant told the appellant to stop talking. And that's on page 18 of the Rasmussen transcript. I kept telling him to stop, and the statement still came forward. Later, besides the order itself, the court clarified its ruling in the transcript before the sergeant testified. And the court said, the sergeant did not ask questions, and by his words and conduct did not say or do anything that would elicit an incriminating response at the time that the statements was made outside the holding cell. All of those are reviewed for clear error, and yes, it is the state's burden to show that, but there was no other testimony. There's nothing from the defendant to say, you know what, he was still asking me questions. And unfortunately, this wasn't recorded because it was walking back to the holding cell. So the only evidence in this record reviewed for clear error are the court's findings of fact, which support the conclusion that this was not an interrogation and that those were spontaneous statements. So the court's ruling, and as the judge mentioned in State versus Paul, the Minnesota Supreme Court case supports that ruling. In that case, they never left the interrogation room. But the interrogation was over and the defendant reinitiated conversations after having invoked his right to counsel, and that was properly admissible. Regarding the...
I don't agree that there isn't any evidence in the record as to the amount of time that passed after they left the interview room and we're going back to the jail when he, when appellant made the statement to the officer?
There's no specific time frame that's mentioned in the in this record, no. But what we do have from this time frame is that there was enough time to pass that the video was turned off, the interrogation ended, the interpreters had left, they were walking back to the holding cell, which is in different building where they were going to return him to jail. So there is a period of time that can be inferred. There's no specific testimony or specific findings that would show that the timing of that. But as in State versus Paul, again, they were still in that interrogation room. And so for the time that elapsed was much shorter in Paul than it is in this situation. Regarding the testimony itself, there was a lot of discussion before the sergeant testified regarding the prosecutor having informed the sergeant about how to testify, about the court clarifying how this testimony should come in, that the prosecutor can use leading questions. And that was all made beforehand. In the testimony itself, the jury had already heard from the mother who said, mentioned her testimony and what she had told to the sergeant. In the sergeant's testimony, it was clear that it was related to, in direct examination, it was related to the holding cell, and that was...
Specifically, was Ms. King's testimony, you heard counsel for the appellant talk about, well, the words woke up were not in her testimony. So what exactly did she testify about?
Woke up was not in her testimony, so the jury had not heard that from the mother yet. Her specific testimony is on 136 of the transcript, and she says, I don't know if she did suck my dick. I don't know if you know that she did that, that she did suck my dick. That is the testimony that the mother said that the appellant had told her. So that is the testimony. But the officer's testimony in redirect examination, and this gets into page 378 of the transcript, and this is the key portion of that. The question was, did you know from your investigation what incident referred to? So this is referring to the officer's investigation, what was in his police report, his interview with the mother, not things that the jury had heard at that point. He started, as counsel had noted and quoted that, and page 378 as well, the 14 words that he stated before the judge said stop and before the prosecutor said stop, when they then had a bench conference at that point, and the judge sustained the objection, instructed the jury to disregard that testimony, and then the prosecutor then went with leading questions to make clear what the word incident referred to. And incident is the sergeant's own interpretation of his word that was in the police report. Incident isn't something that was referred to before. He was describing that word in the police report. And from there, there's the leading questions, and it was about the statement made to the mother, and it was that's what he was referring to as incident, and the officer said yes, and they moved on. So as to the prejudice piece, which Your Honor asked about as well, that gets to that there was an objection, it was sustained, the jury was instructed to disregard that statement, the jury was told in opening instructions about disregarding testimony, again told in closing instructions about disregarding testimony, and this court presumes that the jury follows the court's instructions. So with all of the other evidence that existed, those 14 words were not such that the trial court abused her discretion in denying the motion for a mistrial.
What is a workable test for us to use? You know, if there's questions on ongoing interrogation, you know, that's one basis. But when there's not, I mean, when would a police officer have ginned up enough information, and the allegation from appellant is that, you know, the sergeant was, you know, was kind of pressuring the appellant. What tests should we use? I mean, what guidance is there for an appellate court if this situation is found to be okay, that it was a reinitiation?
Well, the guidance goes into the totality of the circumstances that exist at the time, and it gets into what evidence was presented to the trial court at that time. And with that issue, the evidence here is only limited to the police officer's testimony. Now, had there been additional evidence that existed, had the defendant testified and said, you know what, that's not true. He was badgering me the entire time. The tape recorder turned off and kept asking me questions. That may give a bit more to say, well, you know what, the district court here clearly erred in finding the way she did that this was not an ongoing situation. But we don't have that in this situation. All we have is the sergeant's testimony. And there is the deference given on the clearly erroneous standard to those findings of fact with the credibility determinations that she made at that point. So without that testimony, we're limited to the facts that were before the court. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll rest on the briefs on the remaining issues and ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, Mr. Axelson.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll go right to Judge Siegel's question regarding the test that should be applied here. And I think this court can look at the Innis test and look at the totality of the circumstances in this case, the interrogation that was done by Sergeant Pomerenke that led up to these comments being made, whether those were intended to elicit an incriminating response. And I think that's the test that's already in place and that this court should apply and determine whether or not you can disassociate these comments that are made almost immediately after they leave the interrogation room from all the things Sergeant Pomerenke did in that interrogation room. I also want to reiterate, again, we are not contesting any facts here. We are not contesting what Sergeant Pomerenke testified to. This is not a clearly erroneous standard that needs to be applied here. Whether under the Innis test, that is a legal standard that this court determines. Pomerenke, we're not contesting that Pomerenke said or did anything once they left that room up until the time that Chapman made those statements. What we're saying is that the things he did in that interrogation room led to the comments that were made shortly thereafter. So this court should apply de novo review. I really don't understand the state's argument on that point at all. And we're not challenging any facts here that are made by the judge. All the factual determinations made by the judge are in our favor that interrogation was taking place, despite Pomerenke's testimony that he was just asking biographical questions that had exactly to do with the charges here. Quickly on the harmless error standard, I thought about it a little bit more and just wanted to add one additional thing. Talia King's testimony, and Pomerenke, I think, repeats it, is that she, and I don't have the exact quote, but it's something similar to, that she claims that Chapman said to her, "I don't know if she sucked my penis." And what the comment that did come in under on the way to the jail cell was he would never force his daughter to have sex with him. Those match up pretty well, and those provide corroboration to Talia King's statement. And that's why the error in this case is not harmless, because on the one charge that the jury finds him guilty of, there is multiple references to Chapman admitting to that conduct in this case.
But the jury heard the denial. I mean, is the conversation in the holding area, I suppose you could argue, because you already have Ms. King's testimony in the record.
Yes.
You have the child's testimony in the record.
Yes.
And your client was able to get a denial into the record without testifying. So how do you weigh that? I would never do this. I would never do this to my child.
Well,
I mean, the jury heard that.
I think it's actually coming
from the officer, from a sergeant's mouth.
I would say it's more nuanced than that. I don't think it is a direct denial. I think it is he would never force his daughter to have sex with him is not that he has not had sex with his daughter. He just wouldn't force her to do that. So that one way to read that is that she may or, you know, she, I don't know if she sucked on my penis is very similar to I wouldn't force my daughter to have sex with me. Somebody who hasn't done anything to their child would not say something like that. That is a you know, a comment that is very incriminating in the way that it's said. And unless the court has additional questions, I appreciate your time, and we'd ask for a reversal of this conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you both for your helpful arguments here today and your briefs. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time period. Have a good day. That completes our oral calendar for today.